What we're going to look at now is the idea of leadership and followership. And we've already touched on this subject to a certain extent, but we're going to explore it in a bit more detail. So what I want to start off with is looking at what is leadership all about, understanding leadership. And I'm going to give you a definition now of leadership. It's from the Old English word leaden, which means a road, a way, the path of a ship at sea. It's related to another Old English word, lithan, to travel. So a leader is a person who discovers the right direction in which to travel, takes other people with them, guides and supports them on the journey, and keeps a goal always in their mind's eye. So what that means, basically, is that a leader is somebody who is able to develop what the textbooks call a vision of where you want to be, where are you trying to get to, and then helping people to follow the path to get to wherever it is that you are trying to get to. So that's partly why it's important to recognise that it's not just managers who are leaders. Everybody in an organisation, particularly professionals, can be involved in making sure that you're clear about where you're trying to get to and how you're going to get there. So having that vision, that overview, if you like, of what the whole enterprise is all about, you know, what the whole thing you are doing is all about. Can you see how that fits in with what we were discussing earlier in terms of professionalism? And the idea of having that sort of collective identity of recognising what social work is all about, in a sense, and not just getting bogged down in the details of our own caseload, our own desk, our own computer, or whatever it is, and losing sight of that bigger picture. So from a management point of view, a leader is somebody who enables other people to be able to hold on to that vision of where we're trying to get to and not get lost somewhere on the way. And linked to that then is the idea that people who are not managers, their part in this is what some people call responsible followership. In other words, it's about recognising, well, if the people who are paid to be leaders are trying to get us to where we need to go, what's our part in making that happen? What's our part in supporting that? Now, if you think about it, that's very different from the traditional idea that managers are paid to manage and staff are paid to get on with their job. And they're like two separate domains. So one of the reasons there's such an emphasis on leadership these days is because it's seen as like a sort of an antidote to managerialism. Remember that we were discussing this idea of how over the years public services have been expected to be more like businesses, and that's had a sort of a demoralising effect on people and a deprofessionalising effect. So this has affected managers the same as it's affected practitioners. And so the emphasis on leadership and followership is part of a reaction against managerialism. It's basically saying, let's get hold of our world, if you like. Let's get hold of social work and take it in the direction that we want it to go, rather than just be passive recipients, if you like, of other people's decisions about what should happen. And one of the things we'll look at in another session and link that links in nicely with this is the idea of self-leadership. So being clear for ourselves, where are we going with our lives, with our career, and so on? What do we want out of our job, out of our professionalism, and so on? So that we hold on to our values and we hold on to clarity about where we're trying to get to, what we're trying to achieve, and so on. So it's important to recognise that one of the main reasons that I'm focusing on leadership is that it's a really useful concept, and we'll see in a little while just some of the ways in which it helps us to understand how organisations work, or in some cases, how organisations don't work, and what goes wrong when there's a lack of leadership. Because if you think about it, you've probably seen this in the press or on television documentaries and things like that, where things have gone sadly wrong, it's often claimed there was a lack of leadership. Whether that's in the education system, in social services, or whatever, this is a common sort of complaint, there was a lack of leadership. In other words, the people involved lost the plot. They lost sight of what they were trying to achieve, where they were trying to get to. So that's our starting point for leadership. Let's have a look at some aspects of this. And one of these is aspects we want to look at is how the idea of leadership has come to feature so strongly these days. If you put leadership into Google, for example, you'll get millions of answers to that search, in a sense. Millions will come up. It's a big, big issue these days. Now, you may have heard about Theory X and Theory Y, but it doesn't matter if you haven't, because I'm going to explain them anyway. But this is a long-standing difference in terms of understanding how the world of work operates, and particularly the world of management. So Theory X is based on the idea that people dislike work and try to avoid it. Now, you may have heard of, for example, what's called Taylorism. And that's, funnily enough, named after a man called Taylor, who was the person who was mainly responsible for setting up things like production lines and time and motion and stuff like that. He adopted what he liked to refer to as scientific management. So he tried to look at how places like factories, for example, operated in terms of how to get the best results from the staffing levels they had. So I don't know if you've come across the idea of time and motion. And what that refers to is, it's a bit old-fashioned now, but it used to happen in a lot of workplaces where you'd have inspectors who would watch what people are doing and time them and look at the way they did their job and try and find ways in which they could do it in less time and with less energy. So it was all based on this idea of like a scientific approach to getting the most out of people. And that has been, you know, a dominant way of thinking for a long time in terms of the workplace. And it's based on this idea, this assumption, this theory X, that people dislike work and try to avoid it. So if you want to get the most out of people, you have to push them and cajole them and watch them and give them instructions. Now, that's one school of thought. Another school of thought is what's come to be known as Theory Y, which is the idea that people see work as fulfilling. It's part of their psychological need to find value and meaning. Now, that, as I'm sure you can see, is quite a radically different perspective on work. It's assuming not that if you want to achieve the best results, you must squeeze the most out of people as you can, but rather that what you do is appeal to people's willingness to work because they have a need to find value and meaning in what they do. So that's a development in the thinking, and I'm sure you can see that professionalism fits more with Theory Y than it does with Theory X. But you see how managerialism has been pushing us back towards Theory X, towards targets and performance indicators. So many people, myself included, would see that as a backward step. But then other people have come along and said, well, okay, this traditional distinction between one approach and the other, X and Y, is helpful, but there's more to it than that. So they came up with the idea of Theory Z, that people identify with a corporate vision, value system, and presentation which is accurate and explicit, Now, what that means then is that people not only search for meaning and value in their work, but that they are open to leadership, that they are open to people having this vision of what this is all about, where we're trying to get to. A good example of this is one that's quoted in Peter Gilbert's book on leadership. He gives the example of, in America, the not President Bush that was around a few years ago, but his father, the original President Bush, if you like, visiting NASA, you know, the space agency in America, visiting NASA one day on a sort of an official visit, walking around, chatting to people, shaking hands and so on. And he came across one of the janitors that worked there and started chatting to this janitor and said to him, "And what do you do here?" Now, you'd expect, wouldn't you, if somebody asked a janitor what they do, they'd say, "Oh, well, I'm involved in cleaning. I make sure the toilet rolls are replaced in the restrooms and things like that. And I order supplies and so on." But that's not what this janitor said. What the janitor said when he was asked, "What do you do here?" He said, "Mr. President, I help to put men on the moon." Can you see how that's theory Z? That's about this person seeing that he is playing an important part in an important project, in a sense. That he is part of something bigger than himself. That he is part of this project, rather than just seeing it as what the specific tasks are. So can you say how that's parallel with what I was saying before about it's sad when people, social workers included, lose that broader vision and just see their own caseload and their own pressures and don't see themselves as something bigger and more important. So leadership, including self-leadership, is about making sure that we have some clarity about what is it that we are trying to achieve. Now, I'll just give you another brief example. I've run a number of courses on leadership over the years. And one day I was running a course when one of the people on that course was the manager of a care home for older people. And she said, "Neil, I like what you're saying about leadership. I can see how important it is. But what I find difficult is that I am struggling to be a leader and to motivate my staff when they are on the minimum wage and the job they do is a difficult job. You know, caring for older people can be a demanding, tough job, and yet they're on the minimum wage and the turnover of staff is quite high. You know, a lot of people don't stay around for long and then there's new people coming along. How do I do leadership in that context?" And so I quoted the NASA example to her, and I said, basically, as I see it, your challenge is you need to get across to your staff that what it's about is they are playing an important part in looking after vulnerable older members of our community who are not able to look after themselves. So they're playing an important part in our society, being a humane and caring society. And that will then hopefully give them a sense of what they do being important. And perhaps you could also link that to how would they want, say, if their grandmother or grandfather were being cared for, how would they want them to be cared for as part of this idea of a humane, caring society? So do you see about that fits in this idea of theory Z, of having that bigger vision of what it's all about, rather than just getting bogged down in the detail, losing your sense of direction, losing your motivation, losing your focus in a sense. If we go through this, then in terms of theory X, the sort of the theory X perspective on that is, I'm a practitioner, managers get paid more than I do. Any organisational problems, it's up to them to sort them out. It's got nothing to do with me. Do you see how there's that sort of us-them mentality comes in terms of theory X? I'm only here to pay my bills, to put food on the table and so on. That work is something you tolerate. And so managers can be expected to solve problems, you know, just dump the problem on the manager's desk. That's not going to encourage teamwork, is it? When you get into theory Y, you're starting to get the basis of teamwork there, where it's about, it's not just managers like forcing staff into working, but helping them to achieve their potential, helping them to find meaning and value in their work. And then theory Z adds to that, then takes it a step further by saying, and you can get that sense of value and meaning by working together, by having this sort of shared vision, in a sense, of what you're trying to achieve. It's about pulling people together with a shared sense of what it's all about. And I don't know about you, but my experience over the last 35 years is that some teams are excellent at this. They really pull together, they really support one another. There's a real sense that, you know, we are in this together. It doesn't matter how difficult life gets, we're in this together, so that makes it a lot easier. Whereas other teams, well, it's, in a sense, it's a bit of a distortion of reality to call them a team, because they're not. They're just a collection of individuals who happen to, you know, sit in the same room or share the same set of duties or whatever. Do you see how a manager can't get people to pull together and be their best if they don't want to? It's a bit like, you know, me as a teacher or a trainer, I can do my best to help people learn, but if they don't play their part, no learning's going to take place. If somebody goes on a training course, for example, and they stare out the window all day, I may be doing my bit, but if they're not doing their bit, then it's not going to work. So that's the idea, is that good leadership requires good followership, in a sense. You know, that we all need to pull together. And then it's about moving away from this idea of us and them. You know, that it's up to managers to solve organisational problems. Because if you think about it, that's a bureaucratic model. That's basically saying, I get paid to do my job, managers get paid to manage, so anything to do with organisations, give it to the manager, it's nothing to do with me. And so in a sense, we're disempowering ourselves as professionals if we do that. That's very much theory X territory rather than theory Y or theory Z. So yes, you're right, a lot depends on the skills and ability of the manager in terms of leadership. Let me give you a practical example of that. A while back, a friend of mine came to me and asked me for help. She said, Neil, as you know, I'm a childcare social worker, and childcare social workers tend to be very busy. And I don't mind that because I like being busy. But she said, recently, it's just been ridiculous. I'm working till 7 o'clock every night. I'm taking my files home with me at the weekend to get my records up to date, because I know how dangerous it is to let my records get too far behind. And she said, I just can't keep this up for much longer. It's wearing me out. I'm not seeing much of my family. I'm just getting tireder and tireder. I'm going to be making some serious mistakes if things don't change. And I asked her the obvious question. I said, have you discussed this with your manager, with your supervisor? And she said, yeah, that's part of the problem. And I said, oh, how come? And she said, well, I said to, told my manager what I've just told you, and she just shrugged her shoulders and said, it's the same for everybody. Everybody's rushed off their feet and got way too much to do. We've just got to get on with it. And I said to my friend, if you don't mind my asking, how did you feel when she said that? And she said, I don't mind you asking, and I don't mind telling you that I felt like shit. And I said, that's sad that that was like that. And I said, just imagine if she'd said something similar but subtly different. What if she had said, instead of, it's the same for everybody, just like fobbing her off, what if her manager had said, I've noticed that it seems to be the same for everybody lately. Everybody seems to be under a huge amount of pressure. Everybody seems to be struggling at the moment. We've got a team meeting a week tomorrow. let's put it on the agenda for the team meeting and look at how we can pull together as a team and help each other through this difficult time to make sure that things don't get out of hand. And I said, you see, that's basically saying the same, it's the same for everybody, but with a different emphasis. And so I said to my friend, if she'd said that, how would you have felt then? And she said, Neil, I would have been walking on air. So can you see the difference between feeling like shit and walking on air was down to the leadership or lack of leadership of that manager. So instead of taking the opportunity of getting people to pull together and support each other, that manager pushed them apart by just saying, you are stuck with this, get on with it. Do you see how that's Theory X stuff? Yeah, it's just basically saying, you got too much to do, hard luck, stop whinging, get on with the job, which is not recognising, you know, the significance of the human dimension, if you like, of the workplace and work issues. So can you see the picture I'm trying to paint of leadership and how significant this is? I want to now look at some examples of what good leadership looks like and what poor or non-existent leadership looks like. And these are not a comprehensive list. You know, this is not everything that can apply. These are just some examples to get us thinking and get us discussing the issues. The first important issue I want to emphasise is that leadership is about pulling rather than pushing. And what I mean by that is Theory X is about pushing, isn't it? Get the job done. Focus. Move. It's that sort of top-down mentality, if you like, of trying to get people to get on with their work. So it's about getting the most out of people, trying to screw every last bit of effort out of them. Can you see how that's the push mentality? Whereas leadership is about pull. It's about motivating or even inspiring people, making them want to do well because they are part of an important endeavour. They're part of something that is significant. They are part of, for example, developing a more caring, humane society. They're playing their part in that. Or they're putting people on the moon, wherever it might be. So there's that sense of being motivated and inspired by what you're doing rather than being pushed. Now, what that means then is that when we're talking about pushing, it's about getting the most out of people, whereas the pulling bit, the leadership bit, is getting the best out of people. Can you see the subtle but significant difference there between getting the most out of people and getting the best out of people? Yeah, so somebody who lacks leadership will just try and get people to work as hard as possible, you know, by literally or metaphorically pushing and shoving and cajoling them into working as hard as they can manage to. Whereas a good leader is somebody who will get people motivated, committed, wanting to do the best job possible. So what they're doing is getting the best out of them rather than getting the most out of them. And can you see how that fits with professionalism? That isn't that what we would want from professionalism, is people who are getting the best out of themselves rather than where managers are getting the most out of them. And that's been a criticism of managerialism over the years, that what this top-down, target-driven approach has done is focused on getting the most out of people rather than the best out of people. So we can come back to that later, because that, you know, that's a significant point for discussion. So that links into the next point then, is the difference between coercing and inspiring. So this is where bullying can arise, for example, is where somebody wants somebody else to do something, like a manager wants a member of staff to do something, and they can't inspire them to do it, they haven't got the leadership skills to do it, so they try and coerce them into doing it so that the person on the receiving end then feels that they're being treated harshly, they're being treated unfairly, and perhaps that they're being bullied. So it's about moving away from theory X, which is based on coercion, based on the idea that people will only work hard if you keep a close eye on them and push them into working hard. Whereas leadership is based on more like theory Y and especially theory Z, the idea of inspiring people, of making people want to play an important part in putting someone on the moon or creating a more caring, humane society or whatever it may be. And you see how that's part of that leadership vision, you know, that idea of having something important to aim for and be part of. Then the next distinction is important, and that's between compliance and commitment. Because theory X is based on the idea of compliance. You make people comply. Whereas the idea of leadership is you encourage commitment, that people are committed to what they're doing. They want to achieve their best, not doing it just because they'll get into trouble if they don't. That's about. And that in itself, if you think about it, is quite significant, that emphasis on commitment rather than compliance. You might be familiar with the Munro Review of Child Protection in England. And one of the criticisms that the Munro Review made of existing practices, or existing at that time anyway, was that supervision for many child protection practitioners was too much based on compliance, too much based on have you done this, have you done that, are your records up to date, have you made that visit, have you done what you're supposed to do. Some people call that snoopervision, yeah, just checking up on people. Can you see how that fits with Theory X? This idea of people will only do a good job if they are being watched. They can't be trusted. They have to be watched. They have to be closely controlled. Whereas for leadership, the idea is, and Munro called this reflective supervision. That supervision should be reflective. It shouldn't be about have you done this, have you done that, but of together reflecting on the professional challenges, reflecting on what needs to happen for good practice. So it becomes an empowering process, and that's how supervision should be, according to the Munro Review. And I personally would fully support that. That my experience is that the best supervision is that type of reflective supervision rather than the snoopervision, have you done this, have you done that, the compliance-based supervision. Because, you see, if you give people constantly the message, I am checking up on you, I don't trust you, you see how that undermines trust, it undermines confidence, it undermines professionalism. It's part of the problem, not part of the solution. Then linked to that is the distinction between creating fear and earning respect. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but if you do think about it, it's usually pretty clear that the best leaders, the best managers especially, are the people who earn the respect of their staff, not who have their staff quaking in fear. Or think about your days back in school. Who were the teachers that got respected? Who were the teachers that did well? Were they the ones that people were frightened of? Well, no, because if you respect somebody, you don't have to be frightened of them, do you? Do you see what I mean? Teachers making children frightened of them is just a poor substitute for earning the respect of those children by being good, reliable teachers. So do you see how a similar thing can apply in our profession as well? That if we are not tuned in to this difference between fear and respect, because especially for social workers in certain settings, like in children's services, there is often an element of fear before we've even started. Why do you think there might be fear? What might people be frightened of if a social worker comes knocking on the door? Yeah, that's right, this idea that somehow social work is just about rounding up stray children. Or in the mental health field, it may be that people are frightened they're going to get sectioned. If we're not careful, there's an element of fear to start off with. But what we need to do is replace that fear with respect. You know, that they want to work in partnership with us, not because they're frightened of us, but because they respect what we're trying to do to help them. And that fits in with what we'll look at in terms of effective communication, of being able to connect with people in a meaningful way. That's quite significant. And then coming back to what we were discussing a little while back, there's a distinction there between divide and conquer and building team spirit. Do you see how poor leaders will try and rule through divide and conquer? They'll try and separate people off. And that then undermines teamwork. Their own insecurity prevents teams pulling together. And sadly, I've come across that many times over the years. Whereas what a good leader should be doing, of course, is developing that team spirit of actually getting people to pull together to support each other. Because we'll look at this when we focus on stress, but one of the key issues to bear in mind is that social work is a highly pressurized job. I say in my Understanding Social Work Preparing for Practice book that social work is not for the faint-hearted. You know, it's a very challenging occupation. And we have to recognise that. You know, if somebody comes into social work looking for a cushy number, then they've got serious problems, believe me. So what we have to recognise is that the work is, by its very nature, pressurised. But it doesn't have to be stressful. It doesn't have to harm us. And a key factor there is how much support we get. How much are we able to rely on other people to act as a support for us? So do you see how teams can be crucial? They can make the difference between a manageable amount of pressure and an unmanageable amount that becomes stressful and harmful. So that's important. Then last but not least, this is a very clear sign of poor or non-existent leadership. And that's gossip and innuendo as opposed to clear communication. Yeah, that if there are important issues, do you see how a good leader would be able to create an atmosphere where people are able to talk openly about what those issues are? But if there's no sense of openness in terms of communication, then what you'll get is this sort of gossip and people, you know, innuendo. In other words, people hinting at stuff. Or to put it another way, there's a lot of stuff going on beneath the table that should be on the table. So that's a sure sign that leadership is not working where there is a lack of clear communication and it's all, people find out about stuff through the grapevine because there isn't that solid basis of good leadership based on clear communication. So just to sum up, the picture I've tried to paint here is that leaders are people who are able to have a vision, in a sense, that's bigger than us and will motivate us to move forward positively to achieve what we need to, whether that vision is about protecting children from abuse, whether it's about preventing vulnerable people in the community having to give up their home and go into an institutional setting, or wherever it may be. You know, it's going to be different in different settings, but it's all about not losing sight of that bigger picture of what we are doing as professionals. And to a certain extent, that's a key part of a manager's role, but I would argue that it's everybody's role, in a sense, to play a part. And that's the idea of responsible followership, to make sure that leadership works, you know, that we collectively get where we are going. So you're moving away from the theory X idea of we are the wage slaves, we get on with the job, they're the managers, so let them worry about stuff. Do you see how that doesn't fit with professionalism to do that? So hopefully you can see some strong links between leadership on the one hand and professionalism on the other. A sedimentation model. And what I mean by a sedimentation model is that sediment is what sinks to the bottom, isn't it? So if we're not careful, if we're not clear about what we do, about what our role is, then we end up with other people giving us what they can't deal with. I don't know if any of you have had that experience, but it's very common, just this idea of, well, we don't deal with it, or we can't deal with it, so give it to the social worker. So can you see how that is a dangerous model? Because what it means is people are expecting social workers to be sweeping up after health, education, housing, and a whole range of other stuff, the police, for example, you know, law and order issues, just sweeping up after people in terms of dealing with things that are not their problem, so it must be yours. And so that way, if we're not careful, we get overloaded and pulled in too many directions, stretched too thinly. In 1975, a man called Bill Jordan, who's still writing to this day, still going strong, Bill Jordan said in 1975 that the trouble with British social services is that we provide a fifth-rate service for everybody who wants it, not a first-rate service for those who need it most. Now, I think we've improved since 1975, but I still think we've got a long way to go to address that, of people trying to do too much for too many people and then ending up having all sorts of problems as a result of that. Now, do you see how that sedimentation model is a key factor in that? If the assumption is that social services and social workers exist to plug the gaps in other services, then we're done for. We're doomed. Because that's never going to work. That is just setting us up to fail. The way I see it is the antidote, if you like, is this. Setting out your stall. And what I mean by setting out your stall is being clear about what you do and what you don't do. I mean, a good example of this is health professionals will often say to social services professionals, this is a social problem, therefore it's for you to deal with. But you see how being a social problem doesn't make it a social work problem. Now, because if you think about it, the police deal with social problems. The probation service deal with social problems. There's a whole army of people who deal with social problems who are not social workers. So one of the things we need to do is negotiate and basically say, and this is back to what I mentioned before, professional assertiveness of saying, it may be a social problem, but it's not a social work problem. That's not part of my remit, so that we don't get, like I say, dragged here, there and everywhere, and then end up making a mess of a lot of things. Because if you think about our current child protection system, we are constantly having examples of how it's not working. And yet I am constantly meeting people who are working, you know, they're frontline workers in the child protection system who are telling me how overloaded they are, how many cases they've got. And when I ask them, what are you doing about it, I get this eerie silence. Do you see how that's dangerous? Colluding with dangerous practice because people are overloaded but doing nothing about it is dangerous to vulnerable children. And so that's part of setting out your stall, of saying we can do this but we can't do that. Because if we allow ourselves to be stretched too thinly, well, think about it. It's just totally unrealistic, isn't it? Imagine we didn't have social services in this country. Imagine that we were starting from scratch and a group of us went to see the Prime Minister to say, we want to put this idea to you of setting up comprehensive social services across the whole country. And what we want is to be able to plug all the gaps in people's lives that are left by the health service, by the education system, by the police, probation and courts system. and by the housing system and so on and so forth, by the social security and benefit system, we want to be able to plug all those gaps. Do you think that the Prime Minister, or any Prime Minister, especially not the current one, but any Prime Minister, would be convinced by the logic of doing that? And yet, isn't that what a sedimentation model is? Yeah? This expectation that we mustn't fail, we must be able to solve everybody's problems, even if it's not our job to. So a common refrain you'll hear is perhaps another professional saying, well, if you don't do it, it won't get done. So what's the short answer to that? It won't get done. Because if it's down to you and it's not your job, then why aren't they doing it? Because it's not their job. So why is it it's not their job, so they don't do it, but it's not your job either, but we do? Can you see the contradiction there? So we have to be very careful that we don't allow ourselves to be put in this position where we are doing stuff that's not our job, basically. Now that we've got enough problems, there's enough stuff that is our territory, that is our concern, to be creative about without having then other stuff put onto us, in a sense. Yeah? Because if you're not careful, I don't know if any of you saw this on placement, for example, if you're not careful, you can get pulled here, there and everywhere. You can have people wanting you to be marriage guidance counsellor, all sorts of things, filling in forms for people and so on. And I think what we have to do, and this is where the setting out your stall bit comes in, is we have to be crystal clear about what is our role. What is our focus in working with this individual, this family, and so on, rather than being just like a general family helper? Can you see how dangerous it is if we allow ourselves to just become general family helpers? Because what's that doing in terms of dependency? It's basically saying we will step in where other people are experiencing, are pulling out in a sense from problems. Even if it's not a social work duty, we will do it. But in doing that, you see how we're giving people the message, any problems come to us. We're just there to generally sweep up. And we're not. Because if you think about, you've presumably had social policy teaching, yeah? You've had a social policy module or two. Well, didn't that make it clear that there is a policy mandate for everything we do? You know, that there is a policy that says, we do this to protect children from abuse. We do this to prevent family breakdown. We do this to prevent vulnerable people from being abused. We do this to prevent vulnerable people from having to come into institutional care. We do this to support care leavers. Everything we do, there is a policy mandate behind it. There is like a law and policy foundation to what we do. Now, what we have to do then is stick to that, rather than somebody saying, can you help me with something that is not about preventing abuse, it's not about preventing family breakdown, it's not about maintaining somebody in the community, it's just generally being helpful. I think where a sedimentation model comes in is where another professional has a concern, and then they sees it as it's not their job, you know, because they're a teacher, they're a counsellor, they're a health visitor, or whatever they are. So they think, well, it's not my job, but something needs to be done, so it must be the social worker's job. So you see how that's the idea of sedimentation model. It's like the default setting is, if it's no one else's job, give it to the social worker. And then if we're daft enough, we end up doing it, when it may not be our job. We have to be crystal clear, is there a social work role here or not? We've got to be careful that we don't offer ourselves forward as, wherever your problems are, we are the miracle cure, come to us. Because that is just setting ourselves up to fail, isn't it? Yeah. You know, I've had people, so I used to work in an intake team, so we dealt with all the referrals. And I could probably spend the next hour giving you weird and wonderful examples of things that other professionals referred to us and often got stroppy when we said, no, I'm sorry, but we don't do that. That's not for us. Just, you know, things like picking up prescriptions for people. You know, they'll the GP has signed a prescription for so and so, but they need somebody to pick it up and go to the chemist and deliver this stuff. Could a social worker do that? Well, no, basically, that's not a social work task. Try, you know, the volunteer bureau or something. They may have a volunteer who can do that. But you say, oh, that's not a social work task. But if you're not careful, we get drawn into just seen as we are like the last resort. Anything that anyone else doesn't cover, give it to the social worker. Like, if I give you what may seem a strange example, but it's a very important example. Many years ago, a friend of mine who's a social worker was working with children in care, and she had this one teenage boy who was in a children's home, basically, and she spent a day decorating his bedroom with him. Now, you could say, well, painting and decorating is not a social work role. Made a referral, you know, a GP or something, saying, this person needs painting and decorating. Can you send a social worker around to do the painting and decorating? And the answer would be clearly no. But you see, what this friend of mine was doing was, she had found it really difficult to form a rapport with this boy. That he was very untalkative. And so what she did was spent a day decorating the bedroom with him and made huge progress in forming her relationship with him. So do you see how that was a perfectly legitimate thing to do as part of that plan, but it would be absurd to say that painting and decorating is a social work role. So we have to be crystal clear in terms of what we are doing as to whether is this a social work role or not, because if not, other people will dump stuff on us. And it happens regularly. You know, I can run training courses in pretty much any part of the country and come across examples of this happening, where people have been sort of seduced into doing stuff that they should never have touched. So it's about moving away from this sedimentation model of where we are being called upon to do all sorts of things that are just basically not our role. But you see how it comes back to a lack of professional identity, in a sense. Can you imagine, for example, a plumber goes to unblock somebody's toilet or sink or something, and then that person says to the plumber, I've got a dodgy light switch. While you're here, will you fix it for me? Is that plumber going to fix the light switch, do you think? Yeah, and the chances are there is a plumber, they're not. Yeah? So do you see how they would have to be crystal clear? Well, I'm sorry, but that's not my job. And if that person says, but it's going dark and I'm going to have to do without light, well, do you see how, well, I'm sorry, but that's your problem, not mine. That doesn't make the plumber uncaring. It's just it would be dangerous for a plumber to be fixing light switches for people, especially, you know, if they haven't got the necessary sort of accreditation to do that. They could be putting their career on the line. But you see how the chances are, if a plumber says, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that, you'll have to get an electrician, you may get the odd unreasonable person who'll kick up a fuss, but most people say, okay, fair enough, you are a plumber after all. But sometimes people will try it on. They'll think, well, if they can get you to do things for them, if you're daft enough to do it, then they'll keep on asking. So this setting out your stall is very important, because if we don't give people a clear message, then they won't know what to expect, and so they'll try and get wherever they can. Even if that's not appropriate. And that applies to the families and individuals we work with and to other professionals who need to understand what we do and what we don't do.